Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So we could have a missile launched in 15 minutes from getting a signal. So you get a signal when you're on patrols, and that firing signal comes from Prime Minister through the headquarters at Northwood, and then the missiles are launched. So within 15 minutes, you can have Armageddon on your hands.
Welcome back to the Andy Rowe Show. The HMS Resolution was a nuclear submarine that, with the press of a button, could unleash a nuclear arsenal more destructive than all the bombs dropped in World War II, including the two nuclear bombs dropped on Japan. Richard Humphreys is going to tell you what it was like living aboard the nuclear deterrent, spending months at a time underwater during the Cold War, ready to fire upon Moscow with just 15 minutes' notice. I hope you enjoy the episode. Before we start, a massive thank you to our sponsor this week, Suns, who helped make this show happen. The guys over at Suns are always looking out for ways to help you with your health, and they've done it again with their new Ultimate Immune Health Supplement. It includes all the key vitamins, minerals, and amino acids you need, like D, C, B, zinc. But its special ingredient is the beta-glucan Wellmune, clinically proven in 12 scientific trials. So if you're already taking a multivitamin or are looking for something to strengthen your immune system, then check out suns.co.uk and use the code ANDY30 to get a massive 30 quid off your first order. And importantly, by using our code, you'll be supporting the podcast and the work we do. It's holiday season, and that means that there are stockings to be filled, and this week's episode sponsor, Manscaped, has gone global with the tools to guarantee a very Merry Christmas. Manscaped is the leader in men's below-the-waist grooming, and they've served more than 4 million men worldwide. That's almost 8 million balls. Manscaped's best-selling product is the Performance Package 4.0, which is at the top of every man's wish list this year. Small enough to fit in a stocking, big enough to change a man's life. Whether this is for you, your partner, dad, brother, friend, get them something that they will actually use and is almost guaranteed to get a laugh. Get 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com with the code ARS20. Be the ballsiest gift giver this year with Manscaped. Richard Humphreys, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
You were 18 when you decided to jump on board a nuclear submarine, but that wasn't actually your first choice of military option, was it?
No, I mean, I'd sort of been heavily influenced by this guy called Simon Murray, who'd written a book called Legionnaire on the French Foreign Legion. I read it at school and I was like sort of hooked on it, and I was just gone 17, didn't tell my parents, and made it all the way down to Aubagne in Marseille, where the training centre was at that point. I think there's now one. There's a couple more around sort of towards Paris nowadays. But I made it down there and to join, really. And I did a load of tests, fitness tests mainly, and they checked whether I'd like murdered anyone or...
I don't think it mattered.
It sort of does, actually. There's this sort of myth that you can just turn up, but you can't. You have to go through a whole load of like different processes and stuff.
Yeah, because I thought that the French Foreign Legion was just full of criminals.
Well, I think it used to be I mean, we're talking sort of round about the sort of the when the French were getting involved in sort of excursions into Algeria and all the rest of it post World War II. It was a bit like that. I mean, well, this is over 30 years ago, but now it's quite hard to get into because you get people joining from other sort of elite regiments in France and all the rest of it, and other European forces who leave and then try to join the Legion and stuff. So it's a lot harder. So yeah, I passed all the tests and that, and then this. I remember he was this sort of big, sort of tall English guy who was a corporal in the parachute regiment, which is part of their. One of the regiments that makes up the Legion. And he said, oh, yeah, it's fine, but we're going to need a letter of consent off your parents because you're no longer 18. And I was like, oh, fuck. So it was like, that was never going to happen. I mean, my mom and dad would have never, I wouldn't say they were sort of straight-laced or whatever, but, you know, they I don't think they want their kid marching off to Algiers or whatever. So I came back and I thought, oh, well, I'll sort of hang around and wait till, you know, wait till I'm 18 and then just go back and do it. But I was sort of, one thing led to another. And I was just getting bored, really. And then going back to my sort of holidays as a kid, I'd spent a lot of time in Devon. And when we were in Devon, we used to have this sort of daily trip around the warships. And this was the sort of, when it was sort of the zenith of the post-war Royal Navy, you know, there was about 30-odd submarines, you know, the same amount of warships, if not more, two aircraft carriers and that. And most of them would be tied up near Plymouth. And we used to go every year. And I was sort of a young kid, but it sort of stayed with me, really. And it was sort of like you'd see all these old, sort of decrepit destroyers all rusting up on the side. And then there's these sleek, sort of black messengers of death who were tied up in front of them, and they just looked really cool. And it was the sort of that really attracted me to it, because it was a world that nobody knew much about. And I sort of first heard about learning about it when the sort of Falklands War happened, when there was that whole thing about HMS Conqueror, the nuclear powered submarine that sank the General Belgrano. And it was all very hush hush, and no one knew anything about it. No one commented on submarine operations. And there was a great movie around at that time as well, a German film called Das Boot, which is a fantastic submarine film. So that sort of got me hooked, really. My whole intention was, when I joined the Navy, was to go and do that, really. So I just volunteered for submarines from then. My whole sort of aspect of joining was geared to sort of that aim of serving on subs. Plus, you got paid more. I'd found out.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, you got paid a lot more than you did. And it was quite a bit. It was like over 100, 150 quid extra a month, you know. They called it special service pay, but it was really danger money.
Back in the 80s, that's probably...
Yeah, I mean, that was five nights ashore, you know. Yeah. It's like, you know...
And a house.
Yeah, and a house, yeah, and a car.
Did you have a choice, because you were on the HMS Resolution, right?
Yeah.
And we'll get to that point shortly. But going into your training, did you have a choice whether you were training to be on a nuclear deterrent or a... What's the other one when they're actually... a sub that's actually hunting?
Oh, a hunter-killer.
Yeah.
And so there was three separate boats then. There was also a diesel submarines, which sort of did special ops with the special boat service, dropped them in and out of like different areas, and then did like sort of spy missions, you know, deep into the heart of like, you know, the Barents Sea or whatever. No, you didn't get a choice. You were drafted after you did your training. So the training was basically you could serve in any of these three types of... My preference, I think, would have been to be on one of the old diesel boats, because they were like really, really small. You know, you can still see there's one down in at the Submarine Museum, which dates from the Second World War, but it's not that different. You know, it's got like one deck all the way through. And I used to go down and watch the guys come off of that boat when I was at, because they were based in Portsmouth where the submarine school was. They had a sort of deathly pallor about them because they'd been away, and, you know, and obviously they stunk, but I couldn't get close enough. But they all held themselves, though, you know that you could tell that they knew what they were doing. They knew what they were about. And they laughed a bit, I think, about nuclear submarines, because we had it slightly easier in terms of conditions and that. And there was a bit more room. I mean, you know, the boat that I was on, it was the biggest submarine of its day, but it was still like pretty.
Yeah, we'll talk
hokey
about
pokey trying to get you. But the diesel guys, it was like, you know, they just lived in one floor.
Right.
Everything was on the same level. And that was... There were some good guys, and you found out, particular officer level, all the captains of like nuclear deterrence and stuff, the captains that I'd all started off on diesel boats and made their name sort of doing these covert operations and then moving on to a hunter killer boat or whatever. And then it was the sort of ultimate to then become like captain on the nuclear deterrent or whatever. It was always a sort of a captain who'd been a captain before on one of those submarines was now like was a captain on the, you know, HMS Resolution or whatever.
That earned their stripes, literally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
As far as your training goes, so you've got 11 weeks of theory.
Yeah.
Then you start doing some practical stuff.
Yeah.
One of the things that you did was the escape tank.
Yeah.
Can you talk me through that situation? Because that sounds, I mean, a lot of it sounds grim, what you had to go through. This is the start of the grimness.
Yeah, because it's like, it's sort of the first thing that you do that is actually like what happened on an actual submarine, you know, because it's all good and where all the other theory stuff has been. Are you looking at a screen or studying maps or looking at like various bits of kit and how they work and everything? But the actual submarine escape tank, that's pretty full on. So to end your qualification and then join a submarine, you have to do two free ascents from 30 feet and then a free ascent from 60 feet and then an ascent from 100 feet, which is right at the bottom of the submarine.
So when we're saying ascent, we're saying you are under the water, far underwater, and then you've got to get out.
It's replicating if your submarine was in trouble, but you were still in shallow enough water, you'd be able to quickly escape. So it's you're actually in water. So in the 230 feet ascents, you're at the side. There's a big submarine escape tank, and then you're in another compartment. They then flood that compartment and equalize the pressure in your compartment to that. So it's greater than the pressure in the tank. And then this side door opens. And then you're one by one ducked down. And you've just got swimming trunks on and a life jacket. And you have to sort of breathe out all the way. Because otherwise, if you held your breath, your lungs are explode because you're at a depth.
Oh, no shit.
And then you have to keep breathing out all the way up to the surface. You have to do that twice for 30 feet. There's another side to the tank at 60 feet, and they do exactly the same. And that was probably the worst one, because I remember the guy telling you, if you run out of breath, don't worry if you run out of breath, you've still got 25% left of your lung capacity in there. And I'm like, yeah, all right. So it's like, so you duck me down, and then they make sure that you're breathing out all the way. They jab into your rib cage as you're going up.
Who's doing that?
They have guys. There's called a submarine escape tank training team.
Right.
Who it's their job to put you through this, and they actually come down in a diving bell. So they've got a little bit of air at the top, and they swim out while everyone comes out to get you through it. And then the 100 feet one is really, it's fairly terrifying. Because you're in an actual submarine escape tank hatch that's replicated on board the submarine, so exactly the same as what's on the submarine, and you have to go into the tank. You've got a fully pressurized suit on, so you can breathe normally because you're putting there's a stool on the end of your suit. You put it into an air valve, and it blows your suit up. You're fully like zipped up and everything, so you have your own air that you breathe. You put that in, then they start flooding the water up. It's like 50 pounds per square inch of pressure on you, which is quite a lot. Some people, their eardrums burst because they can't equalise it. You have to equalise the pressure.
Mm.
You know, when you're in an aeroplane sometimes and you get that sort of...
Man, I have to equalise the pressure when I'm in the deep end of a swimming pool.
Well, exactly. Exactly. So it's like that. And then the hatch eventually opens. And then the guys have come down in a diving bell all the way to 100 feet and they swim out. And they attach you. There's a big sort of pole that runs down the middle of it. And it's like, at this point, it's sort of, you don't know what's going on. You just, they ask your name, I think, and your service number, and then you shout that. And then they switch you on, and then you race up this thing in about 10 seconds, remembering to just to keep breathing so your lungs don't get affected. And then you hit the surface. And then they take you out and put you to one side. You have a quick medical once over, and that's it. And a couple of people have actually died on that. And eventually,
I bet they have. I'm thinking, it sounds pretty extreme.
Because of pressure on it, and they phased it out eventually in the 2000s, I think. So they don't,
nice of them. Wasn't it?
Yeah, so they don't do it anymore. But the worst thing was to requalify. You had to requalify for your Dolphins badge every 3 years.
Badge is what submariners have to say.
Yeah, you have to go back down and re-qualify.
So when you've gone through all that, they say, okay, you're going to be on HMS Resolution.
Yeah.
Which is a nuclear deterrent. So it's fully loaded. We'll get into like what it's got, what it's armed with shortly. But tell me about the first time you laid eyes on HMS Resolution. It must have been a freaky looking sight.
Yeah, it was like a quiet evening, and I'll never forget it because it was a sort of evening thing. When we arrived at the base, there was about three or four of us who were joining at the same time. Everything on the whole base is geared towards this thing on the jetty, and it was like we walked through, and it was totally silent. There was no one doing any work on it. There was no machinery because it was quite late at night. And it was just standing there tied up at the side. And it was like, I'd seen some diesel boats and stuff at first of all in my initial training, but it was just like, it was longer than a football pitch. It looked really small though still, because most of the boat is under the water. You only see a little bit of it above the water and stuff, but it just looked, and it was just tied up, and it was just like standing there going, yeah, look at me, I can do this, that and the other. And you could just tell it was just, it was basically the ultimate war machine. It was Britain's most powerful weapon at the time. But it was sort of fairly frightening, actually. And then only doubled by the fact of when we actually got on board. You know, so the first time I went on board, it was like, you know, I nearly fell down the stairs when I initially went down. Then I had to go back on myself and go down another set of stairs. I didn't put my head down and crack my head on a sort of overhanging ladder and stuff, and then made my way down to the... and had made my way all the way down to my sort of bunk where I was allocated a bunk and stuff, and had a little bit of a sort of panic attack. I was like, what's this, you know? I was getting used to the smell of it as well. It was so hot, and there was that claggy sort of heaty smell. And just
people could smoke on there as
and it was just basically stank, you know, and then, you know, sort of farts, oil, heat, claggy, just, it's that sort of smell. And there's a smell from the chemical smell that they have from the CO2 absorption units, which makes a bit of a stink as well. So it was all like, and you could feel your clothes sticking to you after about 10 minutes of being down there. It was fairly rank.
There's a quote in your book where you talk about the smell of the sleeping area.
Yeah.
I'll just read it for you. I'd first be hit by the overarching hum of human flesh in need of a 30-minute soak in a large soapy bath, quickly followed by the secondary whiff of spunked-in socks, shirts and trousers hanging on pegs, mixed with a hint of bad breath, sweaty balls and ass.
Yeah, that's...
It paints a picture.
Yeah, it paints a picture. I mean, not probably one you'd want to paint, but that was generally the general sense of it, was it just... nothing prepares you for it as well. It's just a hum that you just get used to, but you sort of get used to it. It's different if you're alongside when you first join, because you can go up and get some fresh air or whatever. But when you're at sea, and everybody smells though, so you sort of get used to it, because you smell as bad as the next guy, because there's sort of limited time for washing and bathing. You can't have aerosols because it affects the atmosphere. You have to have like roll-on deodorant and stuff. Right. Which is you? I always find roll-on deodorant shit. I don't know about yourself. But.
I'm a roll-on deodorant guy. So, but I can, maybe I can't smell it. Maybe I'm the smelly guy. Yeah.
You never say to a guy, "Oh, you fucking stink," because it's like everybody. You just don't notice it. What I do presume is when you get back from a patrol and we had these sort of VIPs coming on, they must have been like, what is that smell?
Yeah, you had some big VIPs come on board.
We used to have them if they came on before, or the big ones usually came on before. So we had
before, like, you got smelly.
Yeah, so we had the Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mum came down, and I had to. I was the quartermaster at the time, which is like they're sort of in charge of the external security. If you get a VIP on board, you have to sort of open their car door or whatever, and all the rest of it. So that I was being briefed by our coxswain, who's like he's the sort of conduit between the officers and the men. He's a sort of senior NCO who sort of runs everything. He was like, right, don't open the door until the car's at a complete stop. And I was like, yeah, all right, whatever. This car comes along, and then I get to come and then get to open the door, and then the car just fucking carries on. So I'm like running alongside like the Queen Mum, who's just like, not looking at me at all, just like, who is this idiot? And she's like staring out and just blanking me, and I'm going like, bright, and it must have been only for about 10 yards, but it felt like, you know, 100 meters. And then I stopped and opened it, and she said, oh, thank you very much. And then I looked up and I could see the coxswain, who was like looking at me going, you idiot, like this sort of stuff. Thatcher came on board when she was prime minister. She'd been down before, I think, and it was her second. It was her second visit, and I was just coming on watch as quartermaster because I kept watch in a sort of big hut on the side of the jetty. So you had a list of people who could come on board. You right. checked everyone's list, and if the admiral of the fleet came down and wasn't on the list, he wasn't coming on board. You know, he'd have to stay and freeze his nuts off. Right. Until someone gave him permission to come on board or whatever.
It's a nuclear submarine.
Yeah, you're not coming on. And Thatch came on, and so I was talking to my mate on the casing before I went out, and he was loading something through the forward escape hatch, but he couldn't load it down because someone was in the, we couldn't see, it was just someone's shoulder. So he was like, he screamed obscenities at this person to get out of the fucking way. And it was Thatcher, and she looked up and was like, "Can I help you, gentlemen?" And it was like, "Fuck!" So we all sort of run off, and the coxswain came steaming up, and was wanting to know. I just stood there and went, "Yeah, all right." And he said, "Have you seen anybody fucking about?" And I was like, "No." And he was like, and he just went off, and he was looking for the culprit.
And it was Thatcher.
Yeah.
Oh God.
Yeah, but she was sort of all business. There wasn't much like. I don't know, empathy going on there.
Being on board, like, because you would sometimes go off, like your tours would be like 3 months at a time,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And you get on board. Claustrophobia is something that obviously a lot of people would relate to a submarine.
Yeah.
Do people ever lose it when they're on board? And
yeah, I mean, I had a mate who I went through submarine training, and then we got drafted to Resolution, and. Before you go on patrol, you go on what's called a workup, which is 3 weeks of intensive, like, exercises, you know, like hunting other boats or submarines and doing like fire and flood damage drills and everything. And there's a team that come on board and set tasks and everything. And we were about halfway through that, and Philip was his name, well, not his real name, but I was on watch in the control room, and then I heard this sort of awful kerfuffle at the front of the boat, and he was trying to open the hatch. He'd just flipped. He was trying to open the hatch and get off, but he couldn't because obviously it was bared down by all this water pressure from because we were 200 feet down. So he was sort of hauled down and sort of, I think there were a couple of kicks or clubs we used, which I thought was a bit over the top, but because he was obviously in a desperate state, so the last thing he was going to do was start like fighting and flipping his lid, I thought. But so he was sort of roughed up a bit, which left, and of course I'd only just joined, so I couldn't say anything, you know, I was the sort of newbie, so I just had to keep my gob shut. But it was like, it was fairly hairy in terms of like what happened to him. About an hour later, what seemed like an hour later, it was probably two or three, he was gone. They'd got a helicopter over from God knows where. They'd flown out a helicopter to the North Atlantic and taken him off, straight off, never seen again. And, of course, there were no emails or whatever then, so I had no idea what happened to him. I never saw him again in the whole of my service.
All that time on board, like, what do you do to pass time and not become like so irritable that you get into fights and stuff? Like,
I've always loved reading and had a sort of career in books afterwards, so I read a lot. I did some like training and stuff. There was a cycling bike, an exercise bike, and a rowing machine in the missile compartment, so you're cycling your way through. You used to be in the three deck of the missile compartment. There used to be a sort of cycling machine, but like everybody used to go on it. We had a guy who served with us who was like, he was one of the first triathletes and stuff. So he did a sort of keep fit class like twice a week. So we had that. We played movies and stuff. So, you know, there was a lot of that going on. We had like sort of latest Hollywood films. We'd have about 50 films that we'd show. There'd be a pull down. An old-fashioned pull-down screen, you know, a cinema thing. Yeah. And you'd get this old double spool cinema reel, and we'd show. It was fantastic. Switch off all the lights, and then you couldn't have it like really loud, obviously, because of the like acoustic signatures it might be sending out through the hull or whatever. But we used to get like all the latest films and
porn.
The porn was on. That was in the. That would be in the fore ends in the torpedo compartment. So, yeah, we had this guy who was like, used to go to Amsterdam and get all sorts of stuff. So it was just like, but after a while, it's like, come on, man. It's enough. It's just too much after a while. Do you know what I mean? Because you've got to put up with it for 3 months. It drive you insane.
You mentioned before three deck.
Yeah.
Give me a quick sort of guided tour of the sub visually. Like how many decks are there? There are three.
So there are three decks, yeah. So the one deck is the control room, basically. Well, that's where the periscopes are. So that's where all the warfare team are. So the submarine goes to war from the control room. The captain commands the submarine from the control room. The submarine is steered. There are changes of depth. So the after planesman and the fore planesman both are on one deck in the control room. Then there's the navigation center, which tells us where we are, but you're not allowed in there because only two or three people knew exactly where we were at any time. Then going forward of that, you'd have the sort of electronic warfare office, the sonar room, which is the eyes and ears of the submarine, and then the radio shack, where we'd get all signals coming in. We'd only ever receive stuff. We'd only ever listen to stuff. We'd never transmit stuff because that gives away your position. So we could only do it in an extreme emergency. So that's basically everything on one deck. And then right at the front, you'd have a very cool room, which where all the sonar machinery was, which was like, you know, all the computers that drove that looked after the sonars to make sure that they worked. And then going down to two deck, you'd have right at the front would be where the Tigerfish torpedoes were. And then coming back, you'd have where people lived, basically. So you'd have ate. So you'd have the junior rates mess and the galley there.
Food was pretty good, eh?
Yeah, the food was great. Yeah, the food, I mean, the chefs were just out of this world, you know. I mean, they're operating in a, I'd say, not even as big as this half of this room, you know.
So maybe three meters by three meters?
Yeah, 3 meals a day for 143 bikes for 3 months.
And the crazy thing about that is the prep that goes not into just cooking the food, but getting the food on board.
Yeah.
Because the amount of food that you could get on there could feed a family for 5 years, a
family of four for about 5 years.
And then plus you've got all the booze.
Yeah, plus you got all the booze, and then it's just like, but it all gets stowed away because there's a massive freezing compartment, which is under where we ate.
Yeah.
And then there's the galley where they do all the cooking. And then there was the senior rates mess. And then working back, you'd have the wardroom and the coxswain's office with the two main bits, other bits on two deck. And then three deck was where we all lived. So the accommodation, the junior rates, senior rates, there'd be a laundry in there where we'd get our clothes washed. He used to come back smellier than we left him in. But yeah. And then right at the other end of three deck, there was like the missile compartment where they actually sit and launch the actual trigger for it. And then underneath three, so outside where we slept, I was in nine berth, which was AMS-1, where there's sort of hydraulic pumps and bilge pumps. And that's sort of everything forward of the missile compartment then. If you come out of where the WEO fired his trigger, you walk out and then you go back on yourself up the ladders. Just before you get to the missile compartment is the captain's compartment on the right and where all the officers live. So the captain's the only person who has his own compartment. Fair enough. He just sits in there and you sort of have to knock, basically. Worst thing was going to wake him up. Like if you had to go and wake him up at 6 because we were going to periscope depth or whatever, and he was like, time to get up, sir. Fuck off.
Yeah.
And then you go around to the wardroom and stuff, and then they all sat there and had dinner, silver service, which always used to amaze me. Why the fuck you'd want to be waited on hand and foot when you're 300 feet under the North Atlantic? Why it mattered, God only knows. But I guess that was the sort of military hierarchy.
So the officers got head
waiters.
Yeah,
yeah, they got the...
Who were the waiters? Were the waiters brought on there to be waiters?
They were called stewards. Why they wanted to do it, God only knows. But they also had like two jobs. So they'd be a steward serving the meals or whatever, and then they'd be up steering the boat as well. So they did like two separate things. Same with the chefs. You'd get a couple of chefs who'd be foreplanes and after planesmen as well. So to qualify as a submariner, you have to obviously know your own job really well, but you have to know little bits of other people's jobs in case something goes wrong. I don't know, a pipe bursts or something next to you. You have to be able to know the valve to isolate that so the oil doesn't keep pissing out, or say if it's an air burst or it's a fire, you need to know where the extinguishers are or whatever to deal with it and what you can't and cannot do. If you have a fire in your house, you just throw water at it, don't you, all the time? But if you do that on a submarine, you can sort of muck up all the other electrics and stuff, and then you can have then you're in big trouble, and things can get out of hand very, very quickly.
What was your job on?
So I was a tactical system, so I was part of the warfare team. I worked mainly in the control room, which was like any ship contacts or underwater contacts that the sound room had were passed through to us, and we basically evaluated them for like range, course and speed, so it could be like monitored or on the day of the races fired upon. So we'd come up with solutions.
So you would hear if another sub was in range or another, you would hear that?
No, we wouldn't hear it. We'd the sound room, the sonar guys would hear it, and then they'd
pass it on to you.
Pass the information through with the bearing, and then we'd plot its range, course and speed. We did have a submarine that screamed over the top of us once that was terrifying. But
did you hear it?
It literally,
and you weren't in the sound room, you could just hear it.
You could hear it, yeah, you could hear it.
Was it one of your subs or what?
We think it was a French one. It tends to be the French. I don't know why they go they go off piste and just yeah, and that's it. Sort of screamed over the top of us, but it was a good sort of, I guess, 50 feet above us.
What did you guys do?
Stayed where we were, yeah. And it fast as it came, it disappeared. But we all thought we'd been detected. But this captain was like, no, it's going far too fast for them to get a, all they could hear was their own, you know, propellers and stuff. So getting back to the layout of the boat, so then you go back to the missile compartment, then through a bulkhead, and that was three decks. And then we had 16 Polaris missiles on there.
Polaris missiles, are they nukes?
Nuclear missiles, yeah. So we had 16 of those, and they had all the explosive power of all the bombs dropped in the Second World War, including the two.
Combined?
Yeah.
So all the bombs dropped in the Second World War,
yeah,
including the two on Japan, the nuclear bombs, you had that firepower on your submarine?
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
Yeah, that was an eye-opener. There's three decks, and it's very cool and sort of silent. No one sort of goes in there unless you're doing exercises.
Unless you want to have a go on a rowing machine.
Yeah, but obviously the guys who keep watch there, they kept watch on two deck. If you go in, turn left and then right, there's a little console there, which is obviously roped off, and you couldn't go in there. If you did go in there, you'd probably get clubbed around the head with a big baton that was used. Then going through the missile compartments, you get to AMS-2, which is where all the sort of air purifying equipment and CO2 absorption units and where...
Yeah, how does it make oxygen? Because you could be underwater for... You can be underwater for 3 months, right?
Yeah, so it's electrolysis. So there's an electrical... It's a thing called electrolysis. So the water comes in, seawater, it's purified, and then electrical charge is sent through it, and it separates it into its two component parts, hydrogen and oxygen. The hydrogen is then liquefied and pumped overboard, and the oxygen just goes around the boat, and it's a constant process of doing that. And you have to watch the CO2 levels as well. You have to make sure they're below a certain figure, otherwise it's obviously a life-threatening. So just day-to-day existence is life-threatening unless those life support.
In coal mines, they have a budgie, and if the budgie dies,
they know
the levels are too low.
We could have had a newbie and just stuck him there and say, right, if you're not breathing in an hour, well, no, there's something wrong with it.
Because if the oxygen levels start getting too low, you're just going to start falling asleep. You're not going to actually be like, oh, God, I'm feeling a bit light on oxygen.
Yeah, so it's kept, I mean, there's a whole team of world-class sort of marine engineering mechanics who work back in that space.
They're on top of it.
Yeah, who are in charge of that and the sort of nuclear reactor. So, all of AMS-2 is all the sort of life support type stuff is kept there. And then you're faced with a tunnel to either end, two doors. And that is sort of the reactor compartment, but it's not the reactor. It's just a tunnel over the reactor department. So you have to go through that to get to the maneuvering room, which is in MS-3, which is where they looked after the it was like running a small nuclear power station. Six guys headed up by the MEO, who was a lieutenant commander, the marine engineering officer, who's sort of in charge of all of that, and the... There'd be two or three nuclear chiefs of the watch. who'd be like chief petty officer, who'd done like a lot of like nuclear training,
yeah,
and been highly qualified and usually been doing it for about 10 to 15 years.
You're going to need someone like that on the nuclear sub.
I remember seeing the tunnel for the first time and not knowing whether I should open the door or wait for someone to, because nobody had sort of told me. But it's like a hydraulic door, and you open it and then you close it and then you go through. So the two doors are never open at the same time. Then you walk through and then you just open the other door. But you're sort of walking on top of the nuclear reactor, which is a bit...
Do you ever worried about radiation or anything?
Not really, because it's like it's so well controlled. Massive amount of lead shielding to stop any sort of radiation. And the way that the reactor works, you have rods that you can put in that can either make it, there's either less heat or more heat. So it's very much controlled. And it's basically like a steam engine, but instead of coal, you've got uranium 352 or whatever it is to heat up, to make the steam that drives all the life services, that drives all the electrics and powers the propeller. It's an amazing thing, really.
Yeah, it's quite simple a little bit. Yeah. Like the process, like, so you've got these rods that make the water hot. The water then creates steam.
Yeah.
The steam then drives turbines.
Yeah.
Is it quite quiet?
Yeah, very quiet. And the actual size of the reactor is probably about the size of an old wheelie bin, you know?
Ah.
Yeah, but it kicks out a temperature. It's like sort of about 480 to 580 degrees Fahrenheit.
How far could the sub go?
Yeah.
If it was like, we're diving down, we're going from A to B.
You could go around the world.
How many times?
As long, until you were all dead of starvation.
Oh, so this thing can go for as long as you want.
Yeah, I mean, we had to refuel the reactor every 20 years, I think. I mean, don't quote me on that. That might not be, but around about that, I think.
So nuclear power's almost better for the environment, right? In a way.
Well, there is that if it's looked after correctly. But of course, you have these incidents like you've obviously Chernobyl and...
Yeah, when it goes bad, it goes horribly bad.
Yeah. Yeah, we probably wouldn't have exploded. We probably would have melted, I think, if the arse would have just dropped out of the, you know, it would have just melted through the boat because it would have overheated or whatever. But
going back to the training, well, it's not sort of the training, but the crew training situation, you guys would do war games, right? So you'd be involved in stalking your own ships, kind of.
Yeah.
Can you talk me through that situation, because that's quite... full-on, almost quite fun.
Yeah, well, it was quite fun, especially for us, because our patrols were obviously hiding away in the deep, you know, and we wouldn't get a chance to do it. But, you know, it'd be like off the Isle of Arran or what have you, and you have two or three destroyers bearing down on us, and we'd have to try and sink them and, you know, keep out of their way, or we'd get helicopters looking for us, dipping in sonar buoys into the sea, trying to locate us as well. So we'd be hiding from them. We'd do dummy attacks on warships. Yeah, it was great. And we do this for about a week. That was the best bit about workup, I think, was actually, because that was very much what my job was as well. So I'd be doing stuff on the... I was like periscope assistant to the captain. And basically he looks through the periscope and then says the bearings of various things, and I had a sort of, you have a 360 slide rule, which you can try and work out the range with the angle on the bow and the speed that it's doing, and that was pretty cool. So you could do stuff like that, and yeah, it really was fun, and it got us away from that sort of drudgery. Oh my God, we're going on a 3-month patrol soon, so it was sort of, I'm sure they did it to cheer us up before the shit sandwich of the patrol coming up.
Mentally, like a 3-month patrol, you're underwater most of the time, aren't you?
All the time. You have to transit to your patrol area, so you'd leave Aslane and you'd end up on the sort of North Atlantic off the Irish coast. You transit out there and that'd be it. You dive and gone. Yeah. So the longest patrol I did, we dived in May, and then our next saw daylight at the end of August.
Shit. You could go down in the winter and come up in the summer.
yeah.
Did you ever stop and did the sub ever just pull up and go, lads, go for a swim?
Yeah, we did. But that would be all like, that was after work up and before we went on patrol. That wouldn't be anything to do with the patrol cycle. That before we were so after work up, we used to.
What's work up? Is that the
you know the testing when we're tested right. by the you know the fire and the floods and all of that yeah. sort of stuff, and you have to go through the paces.
Yeah.
Of firing missiles and torpedoes and the war games I talked about earlier. So right. after that, we might rock up at like there was the Karlsruhe Ausch was which is one of the most spectacular and beautiful places in the whole of Great Britain, I think. We had a hands to bathe there once, so we and it's a big old torpedo range that they've used since the Second World War. So we went swimming there, and thank God it was at the height of summer as well. Mm. So that was pretty cool.
Talk me through the process of diving and resurfacing, because that must have been a bit of fun. Like when is a sub making those noise? Like
yeah. So it so the main vents open and the water like gushes in. And
gushes in where?
Into the ballast tanks. Okay. And then they fill up and then you to create sort of negative buoyancy, and then you drop. And then once you're sort of going down and stuff, you have like trim tanks which pump water either forward or aft. So you get to sort of neutral buoyancy, so you get your depth correct. And then and then on patrol you have to constantly do that because the weight of the submarine goes down, because the more you're eating food and all the rest of it, you don't really notice it. But and then you need to put, so it's a constant thing of pumping water to different tanks to make sure that the submarine is kept on an even sort of keel, as it were, because you don't want it like that or like this. You just have to keep it, and that's very hard to do, and it takes a lot of experience to get it's called getting the trim correctly and getting right. that buoyancy correct.
When you're going down or when you're going up, do you feel it like you would on, is it like on an aeroplane
yeah. kind of situation? Yeah, it's very much like flying a plane.
When you come up and you get your surface, you're like...
No, it's quite slow. It's quite slow. We did do an emergency surface procedure in part of the work up there where you come flying out of the... In case something's wrong and you have to really get to the surface really quick, if there's an emergency or there's a flood or there's a fire that's gone out of control, you might have to surface really quickly.
Going back to the nukes,
yeah,
people just love hearing about this. Is the fascinating part. Well, I mean, it's all fascinating, don't get me wrong, but this is the bit where it's like you could end the world with a flick of a switch.
Yeah.
How often did you practice firing the nukes, and how quickly could the nukes be fired? You get the order. What's the process?
15 minutes. So we could have a missile. We could have the missiles launched in 15 minutes from getting a signal. So you get a signal when you're on patrol. Say we're on patrol, you get like a weapons readiness test exercise, it's called. And that firing signal comes from Prime Minister through the headquarters at Northwood in London. And then you're brought to a state of readiness, and then a signal sent through, and then two of the officers go and make sure the signal's all authentic. And then within 15 minutes, you can have the missile. You come to a set depth, and the submarine can hover. So you have a hover pump. You can let water in and out, so it has to be sort of stationary and slightly tilted. And then the missiles are launched. Well, exercised. They're not actually launched, but...
Right.
You go through the exercise of launching them. So within 15 minutes, you can have Armageddon on your hands.
Shit. The missiles, would they... So I've got this visual of the sub, this like long sort of barrel underwater.
Mm.
And then the missiles, they come out and they fire from a wing, or they fire from the sub? Or this, if the missile, like, where do the missiles go straight up in the air and around? Or do they go...
Yeah, no, they go straight up in the air. So they're sort of rammed out of the boat. A sort of water ram is like they're fired out, and then as soon as it breaks the surface, there's like first stage rocket motor ignition. So that sort of kicks in the sort of actual element of
the rocket
firing it, and then it just goes straight up into the air, into space, into the atmosphere.
Oh, wow.
And then comes back down and then sends multiple warheads across.
So you're not just firing one rocket, or you're firing one big rocket and then there's warheads that go off that rocket?
So it used to be just one rocket, and then they changed in 1982, the system was changed to a Chevalier warhead. So it was multiple warheads. So if you were like, I don't know, firing it on Moscow, for example, which would have been a target, definitely. So it comes through into the atmosphere, and then at a certain altitude, it would drop multiple decoys, but within those would be the actual warhead that would go off to make it harder for the Soviets to detect it.
And the Soviets were always looking for
it. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's all they did, was like running these hunter-killer boats about the place looking for us and looking for other submarines. But our Royal Navy Hunter Killer Force, who are sort of fantastic, they sort of used to head them off or go and have set twos with them under the water and stuff to harry them away from where we were trying to go and stuff. So
a lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Was there ever a moment where you thought we're going to have to fire the nukes? Or not necessarily you went through the drill and were like, shit, this is happening, but like, was there ever moments where in your head you're thinking, this is real.
Not really, because the amount of times we practiced it, I suppose it became sort of, if anything, a bit of a, oh God, not another drill. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I suppose they tried to do that. So if you actually had to do it, then it'd just be like going through the motions and stuff. But I was one of the people who just, I don't know, I guess I thought it'd never happen, I suppose. I just think it'd be sort of ritual suicide if we were launching nuclear weapons, because that would mean that something had gone drastically wrong already.
And yeah, because you guys would never fire first.
No, like, we'd be a riposte to any attack. So if we were launching our missiles anyway, for example, you'd have to presume that most of the UK had already been wiped out, because we'd be launching a second strike.
Yeah.
So the Russians would have already attacked somewhere. You've got to think that the Americans would have attacked already. So by the time we got involved, it would have been, you know. And of course, it's different geographically for the nuclear states, because America and Russia are so big countries that you're going to need quite a few missiles to obliterate them. Whereas us and the French, who are very smaller geographically, we're in a much more vulnerable position, because it only probably take two or three to put us out of action for good, because we're so much smaller than the Soviet Union and the USA. So we're at a disadvantage right from the get-go, you see, if you're on the receiving end. It's much easier to wipe the UK and France out than it is to wipe out America or us attacking the Russians.
Exactly.
And plus, we'd know about it anyway, because, you know, there's no way that, even in the Cold War, there's no way that we'd just, a nuclear war would start from that. It's not going to start from that. There would obviously been major land war going on across Germany and all the rest of it. So we would have known we would already been at war probably beforehand. So you've got to know that something's drastically wrong. It's like all these politicians who gabble on about, oh, we'd use nuclear weapons. Yeah, but we'd only ever use them as a second strike. They just think that we're going to, you know, the Navy's going to go down and we're going to launch nuclear weapons at here, there and everyone, which is just ridiculous. It's a deterrent, because it's only used as a deterrent. And it obviously works, because we've been nowhere near nuclear war since the continuous at-sea deterrents.
So the whole purpose of it is to say, if you guys nuke
If you did ever do it, then that would be it.
We will nuke you back.
And then you have to assume that they're clever enough
not to do that.
to do it, because, you know, and the Russians themselves had been through, God knows, you know, two world wars, lost millions of people.
Haven't got an appetite for that.
Yeah, Stalin had killed millions. I mean, you've got to think, well, it's just not worth it.
What would you have done? Do you know what you would have you had any plan about what you would have done if you after you'd nuked them, after you'd sent the missiles off? Because you're not sending off your missiles and going back to London.
We would have been on a massive evade operation, I guess.
Yeah, because you've sent your nukes up, knowing that your home's destroyed.
Yeah.
You've just destroyed Russia, some of it.
We would have been picked up anyway on a satellite or whatever launching. The Russians had nuclear depth bombs at this point.
Bombs that drop in the water.
We probably wouldn't have survived very long, but it would have been nice to have
gone to the Maldives or something.
There's a bit in there because we have the letters of last resort.
Tell me what the letters of last resort.
They're letters from the Prime Minister, which tells the captain of the nuclear deterrent what to do in the event of Britain being out of action.
So it's actually an envelope that sits in a safe in the submarine.
In the submarine, only to be opened in the event of, you know, catastrophe Britain. Or whatever.
So in case the British Prime Minister and the Parliament's all wiped out, you open that letter and that tells you what to do in that case. Yeah.
Well, nobody knows, but what they think it is
run.
Run, yeah. Go to a neutral country or whatever. See if you can hide out. Put yourself under the command of another country like the United States or whatever. Launch the missiles or captain's discretion to do what he wants to do. So it's a big responsibility. Hopefully he would have taken us to the Maldives for a quick week's holiday before we got wiped out. But so I would have you don't know. You don't know what had happened, but all I'm saying is by the time if we'd launched our nuclear weapons, then you know that the country was in a
hell of a state.
Oh, exactly.
Leveled.
Yeah. Everyone dead. Can't do anything. Hell nuclear fallout all over the place. Most of Europe destroyed, probably.
There's an element of you thinking that this might not happen and was probably just drills all the time.
Yeah.
But you were actually thinking, shit, we are going to do something.
Yeah.
We're out there for a real...
Yeah, no, purpose. Exactly. And the bottom line is you're out there and you might actually do it. I never thought we would, personally, but there were some people who did. And it's a scary thought to deal with, really. Mm. But that's the sort of role of the nuclear deterrent, I guess, is for it to deter. But if it doesn't, then yeah.
All systems go.
But you've got to think whether it would have been worth it, I guess. Mm.
Yeah, if London gets bombed, you're gonna throw them up there and get Russia. But then it's almost there's another side of it.
Yeah, and there's that self-preservation element as well. If we just sauntered about the place having not fired our missiles, doing like 3 or 4 knots, so like walking pace.
Underwater.
So we were very, very hard to detect. Well, impossible to detect. Well, we never got detected.
How fast could you go? Like, and it's faster underwater than on
the ocean. Yeah. We could do about 25, 30 knots.
Okay.
But it's like we just rolled around at 3 or 4 knots because passive sonar works better at lower speeds.
Yeah.
So when you're listening to things passively, it works better. The sonar works better the slower the speed you are. And of course, the slower the speed you are, the less noise the propeller and the machinery and all the rest of it are making as well.
How deep were you usually if you were like, okay, let's go, how deep would you be?
I can't tell you that.
I was trying to lead into the fishing nets.
Oh, yeah, okay, So I don't know, as a ballpark figure, let's say 300 feet.
Did you ever catch fishing nets?
Yeah, well, we...
Or fishing boats.
Fishing boats. Well, there was for a few hours, maybe even a day, we kept changing course, and the fishing boat was changing course as well. I think we have our underwater wire that we hang out the back of the boat, are caught onto one of their nets, but luckily their skipper had noticed and hacked his fishing nets with it before it got out of hand. But there was a earlier incident. One of the submarines brought down a fishing boat off of... near Aberdeen, I think.
Shit.
Yeah, which was sort of a tragic state of affairs.
Yeah, big.
But yeah, so there's always that. And it used to be like a nightmare if you're out in fishing zones or whatever. And it's a sort of captain's nightmare when you've got a submarine in and amongst fishing boats because you have to be very wary of where their nets are and all the rest of it. So it's best avoided if possible.
Talk me through the last sort of day. You know, what was it like when you finally, you're coming home,
yeah,
you've been out there for 3 months,
Yeah.
And you're coming home, you're about to surface, knowing that this, when you surface now, you're going to be offshore and you're going to get some vitamin D.
Yeah.
And you're going to be able to walk around without watching your head getting knocked on a bell, on a pipe or whatever.
No, it's great. There's part of you that didn't want to go back. I know that seems weird, but you'd all been down there.
Weird, yeah.
Yeah. But part of you had been down there for like 3 months, and it's like you'd made such sort of close sort of bonds or whatever. It was sometimes, especially when VIPs came down, you got thought that they were like, I don't know, invading your privacy or whatever. But then once you got aboard, once you come alongside and got some fresh air into you, it was fantastic. And then we used to go out and get absolutely blitzed down in, there used to be a few pubs in Helensburgh, which was the closest town to where we like were based.
Yeah.
And it was not a pretty sight, probably.
No, a bit intense. Oh, but you guys got booze on.
Oh yeah, yeah, but it was like, it's different though when you go into a pub and that, and you can,
and
actually,
there's females there.
Yeah,
as well.
Exactly.
People that don't smell that fart.
Yeah, again, it was great, and you could just go out and sort of enjoy yourself and not feel like pressured and stuff. And then, yeah, but there was some monstrous drinking occurred usually.
A bit.
But no one died. That was the main thing. And we were never like...
Sailors can drink.
Yeah, but we were never fighty either. There was hardly any ever... I don't remember aggro at all, because we were too like matey. And then there was only sort of other submarine crews who were out drinking, really. And they weren't going to bother us and stuff. Mm. So it was just like, yeah, so you can have a real good time, just get hammered, and then hopefully get some action at the end of the night. But, you know, or you'd come home and...
wake up in a nice soft beer.
Yeah. So no, it was fantastic. It was such an experience to go through. But then, like the first week or so was great. And then we used to go off on holiday or whatever, go to Ibiza or Canaries or whatever, and just get into it a bit more.
I bet you did. Yeah, good places to party.
Ibiza was just starting then, so it was like really good, and like the Canary Islands and stuff was a really good place and that. So it was just a release, really, and yeah, no one got arrested.
Brilliant.
Yeah, no, it was fun. It's good.
Richard, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. That's great.
No worries. And thank you very much for listening. If you want to read Richard's book, it's called Under Pressure. Very entertaining read. I didn't know what I was getting myself into reading a book on submarines, but there's a lot more to learn and a lot more entertaining stories on there if you want to get in touch with that. It's called Under Pressure. And if you like this interview, your reviews and your ratings make a massive difference to us. So get stuck in, and we'll be back again next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.